Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Welcome to another episode of Strictly Business, the podcast in which we speak with some of the brightest minds working in the media business today. I'm Andrew Wallenstein with Variety. A new book is out that is sure to get Hollywood talking about one of its most gossiped family empires, the Redstones. Unscripted, the battle for a media empire and the Redstone family legacy reveals the behind-the-scenes battles that ripped through Viacom and CBS before their merger in 2019. I'm happy to have the book's Pulitzer-winning authors with me today, Jim Stewart and Rachel Abrams. I'll be back with them in just a moment.
When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. Vanta automates compliance for ISO 27001 SOC 2 and more, saving you time and money. Unify your security program management and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, FlowHealth, and Quora use Vanta to build trust and prove security in real time. Access Vanta's free suite of resources to scale your governance, risk, and compliance program at vanta.com/special. That's vanta.com/special.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
come back with Jim Stewart, author of quite a few books that have penetrated the corridors of power from politics to big business, and Rachel Abrams, who was part of the team of investigative journalists who dug into the Harvey Weinstein scandal for the New York Times, where both she and Jim work. Full disclosure, Rachel used to work with me here at Variety, but as she knows, that doesn't mean I will take it easy on her one bit. Welcome, guys.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Thanks for having us.
So, Unscripted tells the story of both Sumner Redstone, the founding father of the Viacom empire, and Leslie Moonves, who had an extraordinary run at CBS. Both men, however, ended their otherwise illustrious careers in pretty messy fashion, as you document so well here. And Jim, I wanted to start with you. You know, there's been a lot of ink spilled on both of these gentlemen. What were you looking for that wasn't already out there? What made you think there was more story to tell?
Well, I had done a lot of reporting, as had Rachel, about what was going on the CBS board at the time of Moonves' ouster. And I knew, even though we had done some reporting in this on the New York Times, there were still a lot of unanswered questions. So I really wanted to get to the bottom of that. I think we were both kind of thinking of it initially as the whole Me Too movement collides with the boardroom culture in corporate America, as we saw it at CBS. Then as we worked on the story and we gained more access, first of all, we got incredible access to documents that weren't disclosed in the book from the boardroom, but we also started getting more and more information from the staff, the nurses inside the Sumner Redstone mansion that also had not been reported. And we realized at some point the story was bigger than that. It wasn't just a corporate boardroom meets Me Too. It was also a family drama that was very, very significant. And we had Sherry Redstone, the daughter, the much underappreciated, to put it mildly, daughter of Sumner Redstone, thrust into a world that not of her choosing, in an attempt to gain control of the companies and the family legacy. So that became the much bigger story, it is a corporate story, it is a Me Too story, but it's much bigger than that. Ultimately, I think it's a family drama.
So Rachel, could you explain for me, in light of all this documentation and other disclosures that came out in your reporting, is there any one thing that people are going to be surprised by that they didn't know from earlier reporting, new light that this book sheds?
Well, I can tell you the one thing I was not surprised by, but really shocked by, was the level of alleged elder abuse that Sumner Redstone suffered toward the end of his life. And the reason why I say I was shocked by this, but not surprised, is that, you know, for somebody like him, with all of his money and all of his resources, you would think that, you know, he would be somewhat insulated from people who were trying to take advantage of him. But the fact that, you know, these two women, Manuela Hertzer and Sydney Holland, were able to insinuate themselves into his life, into his mansion, into his finances, and nearly gain control, it just goes to show you that, I mean, frankly, you know, if it could happen to Sumner Redstone, why couldn't it happen to somebody in your family? And one could argue that his wealth made him a target of people who were trying to gain an upper hand or get rich or whatever. But, you know, just frankly, just the level to which people were able to succeed and siphon away millions of dollars from him, I found that really, really sort of amazing.
And when you say millions of dollars, I think the one thing that stuck with me from this book was $150 million between Hertzer and Holland. I didn't realize it was, I was just absolutely flabbergasted by that. And I think to your point, in a way, the story of Redstone reminded me of celebrities like Michael Jackson or Whitney Houston, where the wealth that you would think would be the insulation actually becomes a prison of sorts. And it just got me thinking, is there going to be a legal legacy from what has transpired here, Jim, in terms of like preventing this kind of activity from happening to moguls or whoever could be taken advantage of like this?
Well, I think you see in the story, I wish I could say yes, that there'd be a lot of progress on this, but not really. The Los Angeles Protective Service Bureau, which supposedly investigated this, did a laughably incomplete job. They never even interviewed the staff members who filed the complaints about the elder abuse. There were lawsuits that might have yielded some significant rulings had they gone to completion. But for reasons that are clear in the story, both sides wanted to settle this. So that never actually went to trial. And I'm sorry to say, probably some people are going to read this and look at, you know, what happened to the companions of Sumner's, you know, Sidney and Manuela, as Rachel mentioned, and say, look, it paid off for them. They by the way, $150 million, which I agree is shocking, that's kind of the bottom line. It was at least $150 million. I think there were many more millions on top of that. Not to mention the shocking fact, they nearly got control. At one point I said, can you imagine Sun Valley with Sidney Holland and Manuela Herzer parading around there? They came very close to that. I don't think people realize how close that came to happening.
And Jim, you've pierced many a veil of secrecy over the course of your reporting career. And so I'm curious how this one measured up to, say, a Disney Wars, another book of yours. I mean, were people willing to talk about this stuff?
Yes, I think, we detailed many sources and there was an extraordinary array of people who ultimately did talk to us in various ways, some completely for attribution, some willing to fact check, but not wanting specific things attributed. And we go into that in the source. But, you know, we got so much information that people really had no choice but to talk. So and I have to say it's unprecedented in what is now a very long career of mine, partly because Rachel, you know, developed a relationship with a confidential source who provided call it a treasure trove is an understatement. I mean, it was a voluminous amount of confidential, detailed information that enabled us to really be a fly on the wall in scenes that I've never had that kind of immediate access. And plus, we got all these texts and emails, and you can kind of be there in real time as you see the struggles going on within the company with, you know, Moonves trying to decide whether to sue the Redstone family, something that nobody has ever understood why he did, but I think you will now, as well as boardroom minutes, letters, an incredible array of texts and emails, and which are, you know, made it a rich load of material from which to weave this tale.
Yeah, I'd say the texts were particularly juicy, particularly shocking, and gave you an insight that is, it really went to the absolute center of what was going on here. Rachel, I want to talk a bit also about Leslie Moonves, who, you know, looms pretty large in the second half of this book. Did you come away from your reporting with a different impression of the man than what you set out to? What did you learn along the way that might have changed what you thought about someone who had a pretty incredible career?
You know, one thing I was really kind of surprised to learn was how indecisive he had been about, you know, this nuclear option to file a lawsuit against the Redstone controlling company, National Amusements. You know, the text, as you can see in the text messages and the communications that he's having with other board members, et cetera, I would have thought that somebody that had risen to the upper echelons of the media world would be somebody who made decisions, stuck with them, you know, showed no signs of vulnerability or waffling or anything like that. But as you'll read in the book, that was not the case here. And that was not the case to sort of an extraordinary degree. I mean, just seeing the cajoling that's going on behind the scenes as he's trying to figure out whether to wage war against the Redstones, that is not the kind of decisiveness I would have perhaps expected with somebody of his stature.
And I will say that after reading this, I think any mogul who reads this will probably never text again, because it'll come back to haunt you. This book will show you that much. And Rachel, you've done extensive reporting on the Me Too saga. And now that we're years away from the fall of Leslie Moonves, I'm also curious to get your sense of how the Me Too movement has played out. Has there been lasting cultural change in this business as a result of the kind of reporting you've done?
Well, I think it's too early to talk about what the lasting changes are going to be. I think, not to sound overly cynical, but companies have become very good at damage control and saying all the right things in the wake of a scandal. But it takes a lot to change a culture, especially a culture where the culture has been ingrained from, you know, the top for years. And one thing that I think is really interesting that, you know, it's still too early to tell, but I do wonder if we're going to see any of these guys come back, right? Like Hollywood especially loves a redemption story. And, you know, some of these guys, are they going to live in exile long enough for people to think, well, you know, if I offer them a movie deal or an executive job, like, I don't think anyone's going to cancel me. And I sort of wonder, you know, are any of these guys going to be coming back? I mean, it's only been, what, 5 years or so, less than 5 years, 6 years-ish since Harvey Weinstein broke. So I do wonder, you know, if we're going to see any comebacks. And I think that'll be really telling in terms of figuring out what's changed and what hasn't.
You know, Andy, I wish I could say that there's been a huge change there. There's no doubt there has been change. For example, again, shocking things. The idea that Les Moonves, as he himself disclosed and we reveal, there was a woman on the CBS payroll who was in the pool of people sitting outside his office, part of whose job was to administer oral sex to him whenever he wanted. I would like to think that that almost unbelievable thing is not happening anymore. On the other hand, I was also very struck, as was Rachel, at how fearful people still are about coming forward. I mean, we have women in the book who had not previously spoken to the press, who I don't think people were aware of had undergone some of these things. And the Me Too has not changed much. They're still afraid of their careers. They're still afraid that they'll be blackballed. They're still afraid that Hollywood in particular and entertainment is a very male dominated industry in which their careers would be ruined. And really, there were people we talked to who would not agree. They said, no, we're not going to put our neck on the line for this. So that is still a serious problem in my view.
Well, so to that point, I mean, this was something that occurred to me as I read the book as well, which was how many other women either didn't want to speak or how many other women you may not even have known of that were implicated in this. And obviously you can't disclose who, what, when, and why, but give a sense of the scale here. In other words, was there, you know, many, many more women who wouldn't speak or many, many more women that you heard things about but couldn't confirm? Perhaps this is even more, the scale here is even greater than you guys have reported.
I mean, Andy, you know this also being a journalist, like whenever you report something, the question is always, well, this is what I know. What don't I know? And, you know, I don't really want to speculate about the universe of how many women might be out there because I don't want to cast aspersions with information I haven't confirmed myself. But I will say that, like, I have talked to people who are related to this story, who say there is no upside for me talking to you. And I just want to emphasize what Jim said, which is that, you know, frankly, as a woman covering some of this stuff the last few years, one of the, I would argue, kind of sexist criticisms for women coming forward in these stories is, well, they just want attention. You know, the floodgates have opened, people just want attention. And I can tell you that, like, more often than not, when I talk to somebody, they see no upside, Moonves, CBS, or regardless. The response I get is, there is no upside for me talking to you. What do I get out of this? My career will be ruined. My children will find out. You know, why would I want this out there? And so I think if anybody thinks that everyone is eager and embraces calls from me or Jim with open arms, I mean, that is really a misconception.
Yeah, Andy, I'd also like to add, I think an important theme in this book that hadn't been explored much is the intersection of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and money. There are many examples here of women, yes, they did undergo pretty horrific behavior on the part of men, but they also got a lot of money. I mean, Sidney Manuela may have walked away with $150 million plus, but there are many, many other women that we ran into in this story who left with many millions of dollars in their bank account with CBS and Viacom shares that just mysteriously showed up in their brokerage accounts. And, you know, frankly, a lot of those people, they didn't want to talk to us. They didn't want to do anything that would put those millions of dollars at risk, like somebody maybe suing them or something. So I think that combination, when you're dealing with very wealthy and powerful people with money to spread around, you're entering a new area of sexual harassment and abuse, in my view.
But what do you guys as reporters do when you have to encounter people like this who have no incentive? What are the reporting, for lack of a better term, tricks of the trade to coax these people to speak to you? I mean, it just sounds very difficult.
I think it really depends on what the person's motivations are for picking up the phone and talking to you. Is somebody talking to you because they don't want this, whatever happened to them, to happen to other people? In which case you can say, look, you know, getting your story out there might be able to, I mean, Megan Toohey, who is one of the reporters on the Weinstein story, has this great line where she talks about saying to women, I can't change what happened to you, but maybe I can prevent it from happening to other people. And I have to confess, I've stolen that on more than one occasion. But some people also, you know, feel that nobody has ever been held accountable to what happened to them. And you have to just reassure folks that, like, we work at the New York Times and we handle all kinds of sensitive information every day. And we know how to keep people confidential. And you have to just reassure folks that, like, you can take action with the information that they give you to maybe, you know, shed a light on something and keep them safe. You know, I think it all comes down to how would you feel if a stranger called you out of the blue and asked you about really sensitive info that you're just going to want to know that they know how to treat you and treat you with respect and keep and hold your confidence. So there's no one size fits all. But I guess those are a couple of things that I like to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think it was a big advantage. There were two of us, and you know, Rachel was able to relate, I think, and you know, bond with a lot of these people in a way that I probably couldn't do. And then there were some examples where maybe it was, you know, good that I was not, you know, immersed so much in the Me Too reporting, because we did sort of, Rachel did a lot of the women who experienced sexual abuse, and I did some myself. And she was right; you never knew what approach it was. But I have to admire the people who spoke, because in no case did it really bring them any immediate advantage to be able to tell the stories.
Yeah, I think one of the great things about this book, I mean, this process was so interesting. And Jim and I, you know, really, I had a, obviously the subject matter was dark at times, but also some of it was quite lighthearted. And Jim and I, you know, really enjoyed this process and working together. And we really played to our strengths. You know, Jim is obviously a very esteemed business reporter, and there are people that are going to answer his phone call that might be more reticent to call me back. And there are people that I might be able to relate to as a 35-year-old woman that would be better for me to call. And it's not like I haven't done corporate investigations. It's not like Jim hasn't spoken to women who have made sexual assault allegations. But, you know, this book being the collision, as Jim said, of Me Too and corporate governance, the two of us really were able to cover a lot of ground, and we really embraced that.
We'll be back in just a moment with more with Rachel Abrams and Jim Stewart.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
And we we are back with the authors of the new book, Unscripted, The Battle for a Media Empire and the Redstone Family Legacy. Rachel, I want to go back to something you had said earlier that reminded me of, I was reading the epilogue just last night, and I think I howled out loud at the part where you guys reported that peers of Leslie Moonves wondered whether he would return to the industry at some point. I can understand why his friends might think that. Do you really think that something like that is possible, as I think you suggested earlier in this conversation?
I just really feel as though, again, Hollywood loves a redemption story. And Leslie Moonves has helped many people in their careers. There are a lot of people, as Jim said, that feel very grateful to him. And I would have to imagine that there is a world where the combination of time, distance, gratitude, perhaps people feeling like they owe him something, like all of those things, I could imagine a world in which they all combine where somebody's willing to give him another shot. And I don't know if it's likely or not, but he's done a lot of favors for a lot of people. He's made a lot of careers, and you know, scandals fade with time. So there's a world in which it could be possible, I suppose. I mean, he's already set up an LLC for his media ventures, I believe in West Hollywood, right? So,
but has this company actually done anything? Do we know anything about his mindset these days? Is he angling for a comeback, or maybe he's just done?
He's been keeping a low profile, but you know, I just think I would be wary of saying never. You know, never say never.
And Andy, you know, I think in fairness to Moonves, he's not a Harvey Weinstein. He was immensely well-liked. He was very popular. He helped many people in their careers. He was an extremely successful chief executive for CBS over all those years. And I've talked to friends of mine in the business in Hollywood who've said, you know, look, I don't really know what happened there, but, you know, I don't want to run afoul of him or across him. I bear him nothing but goodwill. Plus, he's had the staunch support of his very popular wife, Julie Chen. So I would never count him out. And by the way, he's never been charged with a crime. He's never been sued civilly. Most of these incidents happened too long ago. The statute of limitations has run. I would never count him out.
I'm wondering whether we should be counting out Philippe Doman, who, of course, was Redstone's right-hand man. And tell me if I'm getting this wrong, comes off as much of a grifter in this book as Sidney Holland or Manuela Herzer. I mean, have we heard a peep from him since he exited stage left?
Well, he shows up at some charity balls in Palm Beach with his wife. But no, I don't think he shows any interest in the business. Honestly, I don't know how interested he ever really was in the movie business or entertainment per se. He was a corporate lawyer. He became very close to Sumner. He was known as his surrogate son, which he encouraged. And again, you see in the book, there's some testimony from him. He knew what was going on. He knew about all these women. He knew the millions of dollars that were being paid out to him. He was a trustee of the Redstone Trust. And, you know, did he ever say anything about this? Did he ever do anything to stop it? No. He's walked out of there with, you know, many, many millions of dollars. And I'm sure that, you know, he's, from his point of view, this all worked out very well.
And he presided over a period for a company that used to have, I'd say, probably the most valuable brands in media that by the time he left, the likes of MTV, Comedy Central, or were diminished to the point where we may never see them recover. And something that certainly comes across in the book as well. Simple question here. Is this story really over? I mean, I still feel like we're seeing headlines. We saw recently the New York Attorney's Office disclosing about additional payments Moonves agreed to make with regard to a cover-up at the LAPD, Moonves being tipped off by the LAPD with regard to something in that case. Is this even over?
It certainly seems like there are still reverberations from this. And we know that there's the LAPD angle. But also, what is the fate of these two companies? And was Sherry ultimately right with her plans for a merger? I mean, I think there are still a lot of open questions about what the effects of this are going to be.
I've learned over the years, Andy, you can't write a book or even really a long story if you wait until every single aspect of it is played out. There's a lot happening, but it is over in the sense that the arc of the story is Sherry Redstone being drawn in back into the family business and the family drama and having to confront one incredible obstacle after another, starting with the women in the mansion, continuing with Philippe Daumont, then having to deal with Les Moonves suing her. And ultimately, she emerges in charge. And so in that sense, you've got a woman protagonist, first I've ever had in one of my books, confronting all of these obstacles, and she does emerge on top in the end. And in that sense, I think it's a very satisfying narrative.
Although, and I would say Sherry probably emerges as the most fascinating, multifaceted character in the book. The thing that struck me was how she was repeatedly being undermined over and over by people that were on the board, leaders of the respective companies that she controlled. It begs the question where things stand today with her and the combined Paramount Global company. Rachel, how do you see this company faring in this world we're in now, where the streaming wars are at full roar, much bigger companies battling to the death, consolidation anticipation always around the corner? How do you see Sherry faring in all this?
Well, Jim can probably answer some of the corporate questions, but the one thing I would love to just talk about is the sexism that Sherry faced, because, you know, one, this stuff doesn't just change overnight. You know, as detailed in our book, some of the things that she had to put up with, I mean, my jaw hit the floor. I could not believe that adults, experienced adult executives, would treat her and say things to her that anybody with two brain cells to rub against each other would know better. I mean, and it makes me think, like, you know, it's not like, oh, the Me Too movement happened and none of those people work in media anymore and nobody's sexist anymore and everybody's, you know, everything's happily ever after. It's not like the entire companies got rid of everybody that ever worked there and replaced them. So I can't, even though she has gained control of her family empire, I still wonder, frankly, about what kind of indignity she faces and the level of respect that she gets on a daily basis. And as to the future of the company, as you mentioned, consolidation is obviously really important. Jim, why don't you answer that?
Well, I can certainly say that from a Wall Street perspective, even the merged companies, which probably should have merged, you know, long before, if Sherry had her way, they would have. But they're not big enough. They don't have the scale to compete with the big streaming companies in this radically changed media landscape. So there's much speculation that the company will be sold. Sherry herself has said that under the right circumstances, she would not oppose that. I don't believe the next generation in the Redstone family is eager really to take over and run the company. So the stock has run up lately after sinking to a, you know, pretty shockingly low level. And I think that's largely on speculation that some kind of deal will be in the future.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Sherry is also still facing shareholder lawsuits over this merger. Is that something that you think will play a part in its future?
I think those will ultimately be resolved. I strongly suspect that they usually do settle. I mean, I think the respective boards have been very resistant to any kind of settlement, seeing this as kind of a shakedown by the plaintiffs. Honestly, I think in the long term, this may yield some very interesting information, but I don't think it's going to affect the long-term trajectory of the companies.
I also wonder whether we may even be underestimating Sherry and Paramount Global, and we should, of course, note their CEO, Bob Bakish. Is it possible that they could emerge as an acquirer instead of being the one acquired? Or is it just more likely maybe they spin off CBS? Can I get a prediction out of you, Jim?
I'd be very surprised if they are going to be a buyer. It would be very unusual. Being the companies that are the most obvious matches for them are all much larger. It would be very highly unusual for a relatively small market capitalization like Paramount Global to be the one eating up somebody really big.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if by this time next year, we were in a very different situation with this company.
I mean, you might see an interesting merger. You know, the the Discovery Warner Brothers is a very interesting precedent, although I think that one is fairly unusual, where the Discovery managers ended up running a much bigger operation. But that, I think that's the exception rather than the rule.
You know, I wondered what Rupert Murdoch would think after reading this book. What lessons do you think he could take away as he sort of navigates his own complexities of succession in a family empire? What should he take away from your book?
I think that he is probably very pleased at the idea that people will think Succession is not based on him.
Yeah, I would second that.
And speaking of Succession, and my last question, color me crazy, but do you guys have a movie on your hands with this book? Is this something you've got agents out there pitching? Because I'm not joking. I could so see it.
Well, I think we can't say too much about that at this point, but it occurred to us, maybe. I mean, we didn't call them chapters. We called them episodes. And really, we were just kind of having fun with, and we named it Unscripted because it seemed like, A, you could never make it up, and B, it's beyond any reality TV I've seen. But, you know, I've never written a book expecting it to turn into a movie. And by the way, none of my books have turned into movies. And I think Rachel and I both agreed, can we just write a really, really good saga, a good story, and be unsparing with it, and then let the chips fall if they will. If something happens, great.
Well, I'm going to end with a prediction saying Succession has primed the market for this kind of story. I'm looking forward to the Netflix limited series coming soon. Jim, Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time out. Good luck with the book. It was a great read.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
This has been another episode of Strictly Business. Tune in next week for another helping of scintillating conversation with media movers and shakers. And please make sure you subscribe to the podcast to hear future episodes. Also, leave a review in Apple Podcasts and let us know how we're doing.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? It's estimated over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com today.